The following edition of Sioux Valley Voice was recorded live at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, September 10th. My guest was Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. This recording is also available online at ktna.org. The next live taping of Sioux Valley Voice will be on Wednesday, September 24th at 10 a.m. You're listening to KTNA 88.9 FM, Talkeetna. My name is Philip Manning. This week on Sioux Valley Voice, my guest is Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. We'll be discussing the campaign, the legislature, and taking your calls. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, you can call 733-1200 or send us an email, dj@ktna.org. Roger Purcell, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for having me here.
No problem at all. So we're just under 2 months out from the election, and as part of that, we're going to have all of the candidates for State House and State Senate here on Sioux Valley Voice. So I guess just to get us started, why don't you give us a little bit about your background?
Well, I've lived in Alaska for over 50 years. I grew up in the valley outside of Houston, actually inside Houston down there by the Little Susitna River. Lived in a lot of different parts of the state. Yeah, been here before the pipeline, after the pipeline. Know the condition of the state and how hard it was to make a living with the family and that here. Pipeline days and how difficult it was going through high school during the pipeline days, split shifts and the influx of people the way they came up. So we had a lot of challenges. And then the days when there was lots of money coming around, and then we had the ups and the down, the flows through the following years when oil went down to $9 a barrel, then back up to over 100. And so we had times we had lots of money for jobs and then not so much money for jobs and that going around. I've worked everything from helping my family, from building roads to logging, in the commercial fishing industry. I was a police officer. Then I've owned my own businesses since then. My family, we live in Houston. My wife, my son, Micah, she's my wife's with the Amherst Police Department. And I own a small business in Wasilla. And so we have just a few employees, but we love the valley. My wife's from Palmer. My son's born in Palmer. And it's our home. And there's a lot of issues coming up that I think need to be addressed that aren't being addressed by our current legislative official that's here.
Okay. And then politically, you've run for State House before. You were also formerly the mayor of Houston.
Correct.
So any other political offices or campaigns I missed?
Well, I was also I've been on the Planning and Zoning Committee. I was a commissioner with P&Z, and then also I was also under one of the governor's commissioner for the doing the first watershed ordinance right up to protect our rivers and our streams and watersheds. So I was on the very first committee that started that and put one together way back in 1986.
Okay.
And that. So I've been on a couple of community councils. And so I've been very active, been a volunteer fire EMS personnel, EMT-3, for almost 13 and a half years. So I've always been active, Boy Scout leader, committee chair on the Boy Scouts. I sit on the RC&D, Matsu Resource Conservation Development Board, been on there for years as the vice chair. Recently, I've been on the Economic Development Transportation Board for the Matsu Borough. So sit on a few boards along with the work. So I've done a lot of community service over the years.
Okay. And so let's talk a little bit, if you give me sort of the elevator pitch on your platform for State House.
Well, being around for a long time, and I've seen a lot of changes here, I think that District 10, especially the Upper Susitna area, is unique. Our district is so large, and we're almost the size of a little state. We can't say any one type of issue that comes up takes care of the whole district. The Tenina, the Lakes District, the Church District down towards Wasilla, you know, they have needs that have no bearing at all what they are up here. You know, they hear about a dam up here, and they said, well, yeah, we want cheap electricity. But yet on this side of the valley, we know that a dam would be very devastating for the community in that. They have problems with the roads and overcrowding, and they're growing so fast that their road system isn't keeping up, which is their major problems. But they don't look at the issue of Meals on Wheels and their seniors or their medical facility because they have a hospital right there. So we have a variety of how we have to deal with the situation. And I've always felt that the House representative in the area needs to be part of the community, needs to go to the area, sit down with just not in his office and not show up, but has to meet with, you know, like the community council, the senior centers, Waco, the city of Houston, the community councils in the Lakes District and that, and be part of the community, find out what the real needs are. District 10 is going to be the crossroads of the future for transportation. You know, Houston has the Railsburg coming up. It's where the trucker route is going to come into. They're getting ready to build a factory there for LED lighting, which is going to create more jobs as the port opens up. If we don't have somebody who is experienced enough to understand these issues and work together, it could be a boondoggle just thrown together in that. Or we can have somebody who's willing to work with the communities in that and build together. I was with Waco last night and two nights ago, to how ASA is coming through and pointing to put the line right through their major parks and their sled dog areas. And that's a real concern. Well,
and that's the ASAP gas line? Okay.
Yeah. I believe in the big line, the LNG line, that should come down and go down to Port McKenzie where we can have more jobs. But we have an issue where when Chugach Electric and the Railsburg was trying to do it as the mayor of Houston, we worked with Waco together, and there's industrial lines or corridors already set up. We don't need new ones to come through and take up more property, more lands that does need to. We can use the existing ones. When Chugach Electric came through, we did the same thing. We forced them to use those districts and working together. I believe as a House representative, that person can work more proactively with the community in that to get the needs that are done than just sitting back and not caring as much for those needs.
Okay. One of the other things that looking at your campaign website here, you talk a lot about fiscal responsibility within the state. And obviously the state is in a period of deficit spending right now. It's I think $2 billion out of reserves this year and potentially more if and when the state ends up going over budget on that. So where does the what would you do in order to help stop that? Because you say that it's you know, path to not good things, basically, in the future. So how would you curb that?
Well, I think one of the areas that we're not looking at and we have to be more fiscally responsible is when you give the management section or the upper management section just a mandate of cutting the budget. I believe most of your administration sections can be cut between 3% and 6% and not reduce services. But what happens is if you just tell the management, you have a 3% or a 6%, up to a 6% cut, they normally, because they don't want their budgets cut, they like the money that flows through there, is they cut the areas that actually hurts the people that it's supposed to help. An example would be like DOT or the Park Service. They cut parks out that the majority of the people go to. They don't cut parks out that nobody goes to. So I think that the legislators, when they do the cuts working with the governor, has to be more proactive. They have to take a look at the areas that when you do make the cut, but then if the director or the folks inside those departments don't take the cuts out where they need to be, like the upper end management, which is in all of the government in Alaska is too high, they start cutting the lower areas, then those directors need to be put in front of a committee down in Juneau. They must be answers why they made those cuts. And if they can't, then the legislators need to talk to the governor about terminating those people and bring in somebody who will do the job right. And we can do that. It just takes someone down there who will not just back down, but someone who will speak up and just not be one of the sheep that go along with whatever the rest say and just status quo.
Okay. And so you think that's the first place to start cutting then is administrative budgets?
I think the administration budget inside of a department, yes, they're all top heavy, and I've seen it year after year after year. Another thing is we just because it was done one way for the last 50 years doesn't mean it's the best way to do it. When we took over as mayor of Houston, we looked at one of the areas, a big one that we did, is we looked at the snow removal. And they said everybody had been doing it the same way year after year after year. So we did some research. We found a solution to get more snow removed for less money, down to 3 inches instead of 10 inches by using fast 5-ton blades instead of the greater blades that they were using before. And we did 3 times more snow removal, and yet we cut almost $30,000 out of the budget that year in snow removal. 3 times more, less money. Well, we have to be more initiative out there looking for these type of ways to cut with the governor's office and being proactive to bring these type of issues forward.
Okay. You're listening to Sioux Valley Voice. My guest today is Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can call 733-1200 or send us an email at ktna.org. I guess I've mentioned a couple times that you're a candidate, but not your party affiliation, and that's because you don't have one for this particular race.
Well, I'm undeclared. I'm a registered Republican, and I'm still a registered Republican. One of the issues when we talked with a group of us from the party, and that is I don't want to be beholden to any one group, and it seems like today that if you're not in a select group inside the party and that, and you get their backing, and then when you get elected, you're responsible to answer to what they want, whether it's instead of being able to do what's just right. So my decision, and I know a couple of the people's decisions, was running where we weren't answerable to the exact party line what they want you to do. We could do what's right 100% of the time because we didn't have to go and respond back to what they said. I was taken aside by a legislator and told how we was going to be when we got to Juneau with the party and that, and I disagree totally with what they were saying. I'm one of those ones that says, well, if you're going to put $2 million to fly people from the bush to watch a basketball game, my vote's going to be no, and I'm going to say something. Just because the finance chair, who's a Republican, puts it in there, you know, I'm not going to go along with it and say, we're going to waste $2 million. Not when we don't fund $63,000 to the senior center for feeding the seniors on the Meals on Wheels program. And you're telling me you can blow $2 million, but you can't feed our seniors. And I'm supposed to be quiet because I'm in the party and I ran the party line. So I ran undeclared so we can do what's right 100% of the time.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about ballot initiatives. One of them obviously has already come and gone, and that was Proposition 1, which was an effort to repeal the now current and continuing oil tax regime. Now, that initiative failed, but the idea was the proponents of SB 21 said that it would allow for more production. Opponents said it was a giveaway to the oil companies. Where do you fall on that issue? Like I said, it's decided now, but...
Well, since it's already decided now, my biggest concern is if it's going to continue to decline, then in 2 years or 18 months from now, then if it's still declining, and then we need to step back and take a look at it and see. I'm not for just giving money back to any type of large corporation and that uses the resources of Alaska, which is belongs to the people themselves, and say, okay, you have carte blanche. You come to me, you tell me you're gonna do this. We give you the break, and then you don't do it. I'm hoping strongly that they take the message out of what happened. I don't consider it a mandate that they won that election. They only, you know, when they spend over $15 million compared to $500,000, and you only make it by 6%, that's huge loss to my vote. Even though they got a pass, they didn't get a mandate, and so therefore they should take Exxon and BP and Conoco should take a look at this and say, look, you know, I read the paper, you know, yesterday. It said Exxon said, well, doesn't look like we're going to produce anymore. It may continue going down. Well, remember, in 18 months we can pick this back up again, and they should be looking at that. I hope that we start seeing an increase. I hope that they take it seriously, that the people of Alaska want to do what's best, and they do increase.
So you're saying now the onus is on the oil companies to back up what they said as far as increased investment?
That is correct. And if they don't, then we take it back up in 18 months, and they may not like the outcome because fool me once, shame on me. Shame on them, but fool me twice, you know, and then shame on me. You know, so I think all the legislators down there will go up there and not be as forgiving after being given their word in that. So we have to be vigilant. We have to watch. And hopefully they do what they said they're going to do.
Okay. Proposition 2, which will be the rest of these are all coming up on the November ballot. Proposition 2 is a measure that would have the state regulate marijuana the same way it does alcohol as far as legalization and sales and things like that. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I don't smoke. And my wife doesn't smoke. We don't do the drugs. And my wife's with the English Police Department, so she gets if she you know no matter what it goes either way, it's still the you know you have the drug testing mm-hmm. and that. And there's a lot of the areas that people are going to have problems with if it passes with the drug testing, because if they believe that they can still do it, work on certain jobs, they're going to have a real issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to be a hard issue with the legislators. Personally, I have, you know, we don't do it, but I don't see it as big of a problem with as a lot of folks say. It is the biggest cash crop, let's be honest, in the Valley. It has been since I was a little kid. You know, we can bury it, say whatever we want to, but it is. I think it's still going to be there. I think there's still going to be an underground selling of it, even if it is legalized. But I really don't – whichever way will work with it. On the flip side, though, there's a couple things also in the federal law that even if they do legalize it, you can't deposit the money in a bank. I've listened to the whole issue of – you know, where it's still federally regulated. So if you put money in a federally regulated bank, then the IRS can take it. So you can't, if you admit that you're doing it, you can't buy a firearm because it's on the firearm registration form. So I see a lot of things that hasn't been addressed yet.
Right. And I mean, the current administration, though, has presidential administration, the Obama administration, has taken some steps to kind of ease that when it passed in Colorado and Washington, though, right?
Well, yeah, but what happens when the next president comes in?
Well, that's very true.
And he tells the DEA, you know, and he tells Homeland Security, well, you know what, I don't, it's still illegal. And in Colorado, all those nice homes and those bank accounts, well, they're all illegal gains under federal law. So you guys go out there and take them. Mm. Yeah. And that would be my biggest fear. I fear a lot of the federal government being having that power to do that. And with the federal laws not changed, I'd like to, if you're going to change them here, then we should be working on changing them on the federal level as well as fast as possible, because that is something that they legally could do. And I would hope they wouldn't, but you never know what a new president will do.
Okay. Interesting. And then Prop 3 is the increase to minimum wage in the state that would bring it to eventually bring it to 10 and a quarter, and then continue to adjust for inflation after that. Where do you fall on increases to the minimum wage?
Minimum increases, I don't think affect it does have some effect on the bottom line on any small business and that. There are a lot of small businesses, especially in the upper Sustin area, that are just barely making it. But it's just not a matter when you take a look at when the increase of person wages, that's not the only thing it increases. It increases the business owner's Social Security section, all the different, you know, it's like 15% now that the small business has to on top of every dollar they do. So that is increased on it. If it becomes too fast, too high, small businesses can't keep up and they do go out of business. And we have a hard time, especially in the wintertime in the upper Sustin in this area with a 17% unemployment rate as it is that really going to help the smaller businesses keep people employed? Mm. I don't think that the amount that they're talking about right now meets the requirements. Like in Seattle, we went to $15 an hour. I believe that would put a lot of businesses out of business up here. That would put a lot of small mom-and-pop situations. They couldn't afford to hire somebody because it's not $15 an hour. It's actually almost $19 an hour by the time they had all the rest of the stuff on there, and that has to be kept in. So I don't think the 1025 is going to put a lot of people out of business in that. So I believe that it is a fair wage for the people that are working. But we have to be real vigilant not to get to a point where we're actually getting too far ahead, where it then becomes a burden to a point that we start losing businesses and people start getting a higher unemployment rate because they don't have a place to work.
Okay. And then finally, the last proposition. This one doesn't get quite as much attention anymore because of some of the developments that have happened with the Pebble Partnership. But Prop 4 would give legislative authority over big mining projects like Pebble, and it's being called the Bristol Bay Forever initiative, so that the legislature would have the say on allowing big projects like that. What do you think about that?
I'm totally against that. I'll be right up front with that one. We have DNR, which is supposed to put the package together. My biggest complaint, and I've said this from day one, DNR in the state of Alaska has a giant map. And on that map, it says, just like we have in Cache Creek, and we have property out in Cache Creek that we mine, and we have federal mining rights to, we say we can mine in those areas. That is open for mining. And DNR sells a lease, sells you the area, so you, or leases you the area, I should say, not sells you, leases it. And I go out and you go out and you spend millions and millions of dollars doing the EIS, the core sampling, the whole nine yards. You get all the way ready to go, and then the state then says, no, you can't do this. Yeah, we gave you the authority to do it. We took your money. You had all these wages, and now we're telling you that our employees that work for the state, that the legislature already oversees, lied to you because you can't do it. And that's what I think the message just sends out. It's just plain. It comes out and says, DNR was wrong for selling you those information. And so where does the state stand? Well, should the state then have to reimburse the company that comes in here and spends millions and millions of dollars to get set up? Or do we take DNR and go back to them and say, okay, let's take a look at this map and let's find out the areas that we should not be mining, where we should not be interfering with the rivers and the areas that's going to cause a problem. And let's take those things off the map from day one. Let's not just continue having them out there. So if Bristol Bay is an area that have decided that is a non-mining area, then let's make it a non-mining area. But let's go ahead and make it before you sell the leases, not after you sell the leases. Mm. And that's, I think it sends a message out that we're not going to let other companies come in. We are a mineral resource-based state. Without that, oil and mining, we have tourism, we have all these others. But you still have to, the base comes out to keep the state running the way it's set up. You still need those core bases. And I don't think it allows the state, DNR, and that to go out and negotiate to bring companies in that will benefit and get more income coming to the state to keep things running. So I still remember my dad complaining about a 17% income tax before the pipeline. I mean, a lot of folks that are old around here can remember those days. Mm-hmm. A lot of the new folks that come up here don't remember that it was 17% out of your paycheck just to keep the state running in that, and counting dimes, nickels, and quarters to buy gas back in those days just to get to the grocery store up here after that paycheck got taken out. So we get rid of the golden goose. We get income tax back. I'm totally against it. So let's go back to the base and let's find out where we need to take those spots off the map today, not after the fact.
Okay, and so you're saying there's a balance to be struck there as far as resource development, but still preserving, like in this case, the rivers and streams, things like that. Because one of the other big industries is commercial fishing, yes. Especially in the Bristol Bay area, of course, but throughout the state as well, fishing is a big deal. And one of the things that's always struck me is that this Pebble is one of those areas where you have two of those big industries that clashed and. At the moment, it's, you know, obviously still up in the air, but Pebble Partnership has lost a lot of their major financial backing and things like that. And the project, you know, it's pretty uncertain right now, even if it is to be permitted, whether or not it could go forward. So
that's very true. And one of the things that Pebble, if they came in and said it's an open pit mine with the big dam, with all the, like what they originally, which they never presented that, but they put it out in its prospectus so they could go out there and find financial mm-hmm. backers and stuff. I'd be one of the first ones to vote no, you can't build that here, because it is something that I think is not feasible with the fact that you could endanger the rivers and that in the area. Now, if it's an underground mine, they scale it back. They do an underground mine with controlled tailings that goes into a pond that's nowhere near, you know, because it's 150 miles from the headwaters anyway. But if you had those situations put up, well, then I wouldn't be opposed to it. It'd be a smaller scale. It could mm-hmm. still be active. It could still be. So there is a point where, and that's one nice thing about sitting on the Matsu Resource Conservation mm-hmm. and Development Board. We've helped put in, you know, conservation along with development in the areas. I don't think a lot of people would be upset if it had a small mine in the area. A big mine, I agree, it shouldn't be there.
Okay. My guest today is Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can give us a call 733-1200 or send an email to dj@ktna.org. We'll take a break at the bottom of the hour, but we still got a little bit of time before we get to that. So let's talk a little bit about along the terms of resource development, and you alluded to it earlier, is the pipeline. One of the questions I had written down was ASAP or AKLNG, and you've already answered that by saying liquefied natural gas. One thing that was interesting, you said you'd like it to go to Port McKenzie, but that's not the current plan. The current plan is for it to go to Nikiski. So, I mean, is there a way, would you push to change that?
Actually, supposedly, because the EIS isn't done, they're not supposed to have a location where it's going to anyway. It's supposed to be up in the air, and Port McKenzie is one of the spots that is on the list.
Okay.
Where it could go. We had this discussion two nights ago with Bernhalter. You know, for the Valley and for future jobs and future industries, especially after products like propane and ethanol, mm-hmm. and any of those others, having in Port McKenzie in a deep water port where the big tankers can come in and but also have the 14 square miles of job availability to put factories in that. In the industrial zone that the borough has put out, means good, high-paying living jobs for everybody in the MATSU. Nikiski is owned by the oil companies, and I understand, but that means we're not going to have the offshoot of the aftermarket jobs that could possibly develop from it. So, and the other part is, I think they're forgetting is, we talked about commercial fishing. When mm-hmm. they put it in Nikiski, then the Homeland Security Act comes into effect, and I know that those rivers up there are buoy places for a lot of commercial fishermen. That's all going to go away. And I don't think that's even been addressed yet by the EIS of how many commercial fishermen that's actually going to displace when it goes in.
Okay, so explain that to me a little bit. So they don't let people within certain distance of it, basically?
Correct. If you go down to Valdez right now and you get anywhere near, you know, the terminal, Coast Guard comes out and sights you and searches your boat. And the same thing is going to happen there. Once the facility goes in, and there's going to be, you know, because it's close to a couple of the major rivers through there that is used for commercial fishermen, you're not allowed to have any type of boats that is not permitted, you know, by the Coast Guard and the facility to go inside the zone. And mm-hmm. that's all happened since 9/11. I've had friends in Valdez who are fishing who have gotten too close, and they've been pulled over by the Coast Guard and given hefty tickets for being inside that zone while they're fishing. So if you don't know where the GPS location is, even on your pleasure boat, you know, you could end up with a nasty little fine.
And do you happen to know what the radius of that zone is, just out of curiosity?
No, I don't, but I know it's a long ways, because when I go out there fishing with my buddy on his boat, we make a wide berth, because he got sighted one time.
Gotcha, yeah, once bitten, twice shy. So, okay, and as far as that, you know, there's discussion. Governor Parnell put out some press release the other day talking about how the administration is talking to Japan, and they're already kind of trying to set up the market for this liquefied natural gas. One thing about the LNG line versus the ASAP line is the ASAP line would potentially be, it would be easier to get gas to Alaska. As far as to use in people's homes, it would involve less of a process, basically. The AKLNG plan, they say there's going to be five of these straddle plants, at least five, throughout the state. And that it would be up to the legislature ultimately to determine where those go. And now everybody wants it. So how would the legislature then determine where those plants are going to go? Because they're expensive. I mean, obviously, Nenana, Fairbanks, they need it badly for their energy costs. But how would that prioritization happen if you were in the House?
Well, first off, if getting into the House is going to have to be some major work, because, you know, last year the Senate passed an energy bill for the large LNG type, where a dividend would be sent back to help cover costs. Hmm. I'm fully disagreed with the way they did it, and I did talk to some of the senators and the House reps at the time. We're going to give low energy to Fairbanks. We're going to give low energy cost to Anchorage. But the rest of us who are on fuel oil or alternative energy, you know, and takes our time for cutting firewood, or even some mm-hmm. who use coal inside their houses out through here from Yosemite, we are penalized because a large mass of people want to have cheap energy. Where the LNG plant comes through down, if we do it down the corridor all the way to Port McKenzie, we will be able then to have offshoots that can be built, put through the Matsu Valley and different all the way through and give the opportunity. That doesn't mean everybody's going to take the opportunity, but gives the opportunity for lower cost natural gas to the area. I feel that we are the fat. Well, it's not. I feel we know we're the fastest growing borough in the state of Alaska. We're the 47th fastest in the country. They're saying now by 2025 we'll be over 250,000 people in the valley. So why should we be penalized so that Anchorage and Fairbanks can have inexpensive gas? Shouldn't we have it coming through with the off points to where we all have the opportunity to be able to tie into it? And that's what I would be fighting for, is the opportunity to give everybody that shot to be able to tie into and get low-cost energy, not just giving it to Anchorage and Fairbanks and then that money being taken out of the state and by large corporations, but give it back to the people too.
Okay. And then as far as the big driver for a lot of folks who support the LNG line is the fact that it would mean an extra revenue stream for the state. Is that part of your reason for supporting it as well?
Yeah, I heard the other day that it's only going to bring in 20% of what the original thought was, and it's just a drop in the bucket. Well, I don't think $700 million is a drop in the bucket. $700 million in revenue each year going to the state, I think, keeps the wolves at bay, and we don't have to look at an income tax. And I mean, yeah, granted, it's not like the oil revenue we receive from the North Slope, but I don't know of anybody who would just sneeze and balk at that amount of money going to the state.
Okay. All right. Well, we are just about at the bottom of the hour, so we will take a quick break and be back with the second half of Sioux Valley Voice. My guest today is Roger Purcell, a candidate for State House Seat 10. If you want to join us in the conversation in the second half, the number is 733-1200, or you can send us an email, dj@ktna.org, and we'll be right back. We're back. You're listening to Sioux Valley Voice, KTNA's public affairs program. My name's Philip Manning. My guest today is Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. We're talking about some of the issues facing the state and the legislature, and we are also taking your calls. So if you want to give us a call, the number is 733-1200, or you can send us an email, dj@ktna.org. So we ended the first half talking about the LNG line, which is, it seems like pretty much everybody is in favor of some of the LNG line in some form or fashion. The argument is mostly around who controls what stake, where the state's, you know, where the state's investment and potential return on investment comes from, things like that. But it's not the only energy issue facing the state, and specifically in this area. There's a lot of attention that gets paid to Susitna-Wautauna Hydro, and you mentioned it earlier in the show about the conflict between the need for inexpensive energy elsewhere versus the concern here that a lot of folks have for fisheries and for, you know, recreation and all of the other potential issues that come along with a dam of that size. We're currently in a research cycle for that dam. $20 million went from the legislature to fund that research this year. Would you have voted for that funding for research on the dam?
No. It's the wrong place. It's plain and simple. You know, hydro is good. The dam in this location is not as far as I am concerned, I am not sold that it is the correct place to put it. There are areas right off of the lines or that are already in place that they could put a dam in and create the power needed and tie into an existing corridor across the bay, and that especially with the gold belt lines and that come with the electrical lines coming down through. On that, because the size of what the dam is and how much it's going to cost, plus the impact to an area, it's what's surprising to me is a lot of times we pick areas that has already established their niche in Alaska, and mm-hmm. then we want them to change. You know, it amazes me, you know, Talkeetna here has the Denali, it has the tourism industry. It has set itself up and has very successfully set itself up as a tourist designated attraction for coming in, and they've built their whole economy based on that. So then you come in and you want to change the economy into something different than it's already set up. Where you have areas that aren't set up with those already in place mm-hmm. that you could put it in and be more beneficial. You know, you don't put the ASA line right through the middle of Willow, right through the dog mushing and shut dog mushing down and through two parks that they're spending this money on to bring tourism in. When you have an industrial line and then you have an industrial corridor in Houston, which is right next door, that has already set it up and has fought to get the rail spur. It's fought to get an industrial corridor to work with Port McKenzie. And it just amazes me that we don't work with the areas that want that type of development, and we try to put in areas that doesn't want that type of an area, the majority of the people. But on the flip side, I'm not one of, you know, not in my backyard type person either. You know, we shut down areas for the whole Matsu borough. Like, well, let's take logging, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, we're the size of a large state, and we can't log anywhere inside of our state. Should we have restrictions in some areas for logging? Of course we should. But we shouldn't have a carte blanche for the whole area. So getting back to your answer, no, I would not have voted for it.
Okay. And moving on from energy, let's talk a little bit about education. The education bill and the back and forth on that, in addition to the LNG bill, is a big part of what held up the legislature and caused the legislature to run over this year. Where do you see the state's need for the future as far as education funding goes? There's back and forth on whether it should be in these grant-type fundings, whether it should be in the per-student allocation. Where do you see this? Where do you see the right solution there?
In any community, that I believe that the solutions that we have to be from the community itself. You know, we elect school board members who then knows their areas, they know their schools and that. I think it's hypocritical of us to want to say let. And most of that comes, you know, from Anchorage. You know, what A is good for Anchorage schools is good for, you know, the Sioux Valley schools, and it's not. I don't believe it. I think the setup in Anchorage is they have so much waste, so much money that they're blowing in their school districts and that it hurts all of us throughout the rest of the state. So I think it should be left more in the local hand control. They have a better understanding of what the needs are for their community. But I think we should also turn around there and flip it to where we have more areas that we can do more vocational type training inside the areas. A school that relies on commercial fishing, or the community that relies on commercial fishing and the sea and that, why don't we have a vocational school inside there that teaches boat mechanics or building boats or has something that they can get an actual hands-on training inside the school as they're going through their high school and that, so they can go into the industry that's in the area. Mm-hmm. I think we should go more in that route, that we should leave more of the vocational style and turn our schools more into getting them prepared for the real world, and just not that college isn't a bad thing, but just not teaching them to go to college because they can pass a test, but have them when they come out of school that they actually hands-on get a job and work and make a good living.
Okay. One of the other education issues that came up in the last session is the proposal for a constitutional amendment that would would have allowed public funding to go to private educational institutions, and a lot of folks saw that as a gateway to vouchers, school vouchers. Where do you stand on that?
Well, my son goes to a charter school, and it's a good charter school, and we really like it. But we're more involved in our school. You know, we go the wife goes in and you know, on Fridays and helps with the janitorial. I carpool the kids in. We enjoy the charter school more than we do going to the larger public school. That was a choice that we made, and we changed our lifestyle to be able to take our son to a charter school. Now, on the flip side, though, the charter schools get a lot less money than the public school. Even though we pay the same, you know, we have a house, we pay the same taxes, we get a lot less money. But for some reason, in the charter schools, you know, we have iPads, we have individual computers, and it seems like we have more with less money for the kids. In not every case, but in the case that we're at, it's a good mix on the lesser money. So I'm not for the voucher, but I do believe that we should allow for more of the charter schools, which are part of the school district, to receive an equal amount, and then give parents the opportunity if they feel that the local school there, because it's still in the school system, and it's still regulated, you know, by the school board in that area, but give them more of that type of opportunity. So vouchers I'm against, but having more of that style, which goes back to where I believe in the vocational schools, having more of those made available and keeping the funding inside that location.
Okay. So, and it sounds like as far as the state's fiscal shape goes, whether it be schools or the general budget, it sounds like a lot of what you're talking about is not huge overhauls or huge changes, but just efficiency.
I think you need efficiency in the schools, and the schools need to be held accountable. Our school district here in the Valley runs on a lot less money than the school district in Anchorage, but yet we have a higher graduation rate, and I firmly believe all of our schools are doing a lot better than the Anchorage schools. But yet we seem to just throw hundreds of millions of dollars extra into the Anchorage schools, and then we neglect the schools that are actually doing a good job, because we do, I call it the welfare giveaway of Anchorage. And we neglect the rest of the schools that could be using that type of funding to help and create better situations for each of the kids in our areas. So I think we have to look at it strongly. And just because we change the name of something, or we don't want to turn around there and have a grading system because how, you know, we don't want to embarrass Anchorage. We're not Anchorage. And I think that for too long, we've let that get away with it.
Okay.
And so we need to make the change over that direction.
And then how would you balance that then with the fact that a lot of Anchorage schools do have unique needs that we don't necessarily see out here? I'm thinking specifically of like East High, which was, there was a national story recently that it was one of the most ethnically, linguistically diverse high schools in the country. And so obviously that's going to require a bit more effort. How do you counterbalance that so that you do, in your words, make it more fair for the other districts, but still make sure that we're accommodating those students?
Well, I find it interesting that when my grandparents came over, didn't speak any English, and had to learn English, and the kids all had to learn English, and we didn't, the schools didn't say, take us and say, okay, well, we're going to find you a Slavic translator to teach you how to speak English. And yet our family, all of our family, the kids in our family all got degrees. And yet they didn't have to be catered all the way through. Now, in some areas, if you have the ability to help with the change, because when you go to college or you go to the higher educational vocabulary schools, are they going to have those same breaks for you or at the job site? So if you're teaching somebody and they're not learning the basics of how to work in the real world, is what I call it, I think you're actually making it harder in the long run for those children to get into the real working job. If you learn everything in another language and then you go to try to do a mechanic on a Cessna for a small air carrier service, and you don't speak very good English, you can't read English, but you've got a high school education because you got it in the language you're in, how well are you actually going to do working for that small aviation company as a mechanic?
Okay. We could go on about any of these topics for an entire hour, I think, but we're down to about the last 15 minutes here, and I do want to talk a little bit about specific issues in the Upper Valley. But before we do that, I want to remind listeners one more time, my guest today is Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can call 733-1200 or send us an email, dj@ktna.org. So with the last 15 minutes or so here, let's talk a little bit about what's facing the Upper Valley. So like you said, this is a fairly big house district with a lot of diverse areas as far as population density and industry and all that stuff. So when it comes to the Upper Valley, what do you see is the biggest issue facing the area, and what would you do about it?
Well, I think some of it's transportation. Our transportation corridors and our roads are one of our, I believe, have been neglected by the borough and by the state for quite some time. We're finally getting a little bit of funding coming in, but we're not keeping up with the growth. We're not keeping up with the seniors that are coming in into this area. And so I feel one area is transportation corridors that we are not adequately funding to meet the needs of the people. The second thing up here is that we have, especially this area, we have a large senior population that's growing faster than anywhere else. Yet we're not keeping up statewide with the facilities needed to help our seniors in this area. So there's two areas right there. Again, I would not be letting someone come in here and hurt an already good developed working industry by, like the dam would, you know, for the tourism industry. I would be making sure that those type of industries were kept away. But yet, like in Houston, putting in the industrial corridor and an LED factory in that, which is going to create quite a few jobs in the Houston area, those need to move forward because that's what they're doing. And so the main thing is, I think, is the corridors. We set up the rail spur corridor, it comes in. We put the new trucker route right beside it, which would mean would cut off at least 35 minutes of driving time going to Anchorage from Talkeetna alone right into downtown Anchorage, which would be really nice. But it also opens up the jobs down at Port McKenzie, which are would be high-paying, good jobs, and especially the union jobs and that, which would actually make it then time-feasible for people in the Upper Sisson area to go down and find those jobs on a year-round basis. So the transportation corridors is a big plus for me to work on and keep moving forward.
Okay, so specifically to Port McKenzie, that transportation corridor?
I believe that is the future of a lot of the jobs and a lot of the ability for Upper Sisson, but for our whole district. I mean, they're starting to call it the Golden Triangle of transportation. I know Fairbanks, will, you know, if they put the road trucker route in with the rail spur, they get that port going, it's like a $10 million a year savings in transportation costs on goods going to Fairbanks.
Okay.
Well, does that not help? Well, and on the way up to Fairbanks, they drop off goods here. They drop off goods on the way. Does that not reduce the cost of groceries, the grocery store, gas, you know, gasoline, if they have the tank farm down there and they're buying fuel at bulk rates, which they're building right now? So we could get lower, they can buy at lower rates, store it, sell it at the lower rates, and keep the fuel costs down. So we have some really good opportunity in those areas.
Okay. And we did actually, we've got a couple, and I just got another one, an amended email question. So let's take a look at these here. I've got a question that says, what do you think of a smaller capacity gas line that would allow the gas to last for hundreds of years and would serve mainly Alaskans and would displace the need for a hydroelectric project, which, I mean, it sounds kind of like what the state's looking at with ASAP.
Excuse me, sorry about that.
No problem.
I don't, with the cost of what the pipeline coming down, we would never be able, and this is just being realistic, we would never be able to get enough legislators to agree to spend the billions of dollars it would take for a small ASA line to come down without the return back to the state in some way. You're not going to get the Kodiak representative or the Sitka representative to vote on those situations. We have to be realistic on how we're going to be able to do this. So that, I believe the only feasible one that will actually fund the area is the large LNG plant that comes down. And I'd like to see to where we have the jobs that come off of it. And that will last for, you know, longer than our lifetime and our children's lifetime as it is. And hopefully by then, we'll get good enough in our alternative energy resources, solar, wind, or whatever else that we go on. Right now, we're not quite there on the battery situation where we can store the energy during the cold winter months and the rest. But hopefully in 50 to 100 years, we get past that area and we do have the alternative. We don't have to keep using fossil fuels. And one day we will be there. We're not there now, but I'm hoping by the time we don't have to wait 150 years for that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's actually another question on the same email. It says, you mentioned service with the Boy Scouts. How do you feel about their recent decision to allow gay kids to continue in the scouting program, and should their parents be allowed to be scoutmasters if they're same-sex couples? This is a question that's been going on with the Boy Scouts of America since I was in the Scouts.
Yeah, and my son stayed a scout. We didn't switch him over. So, I grew up here and we had friends in the family that were, alternative lifestyle. So I've never had a issue or felt uncomfortable because I grew up with folks that were alternate lifestyle. So I don't have a problem with it.
Okay. And another question that came in on a similar vein, would you support an amendment to reverse the state's same-sex marriage ban or a court challenge to reverse it, there is a court challenge underway right now?
If I recall right, wasn't that a vote of the people? I don't remember now. I'm sorry.
It was an amendment that was voted on by the population in 90. I'm going to get the year wrong, but I think it was about 96, maybe later.
Yeah, there's no reason in this day and age why we have these type of restrictions. I just feel it's wrong, but I don't believe we should have special laws made up to go along with it.
Okay.
We all should be treated equally on all sides. But so I don't have if the couple and the church and their pastor marry them in their own church and that in the alternate lifestyle, that's up to them and their maker. It's not up to me to tell them what they should do.
Okay. And then we've got about 10 minutes left, so we probably do still have time to take a call if somebody wants to call in. 733-1200 or dj@ktna.org. Let's talk a little bit. You've talked about tourism in the Upper Valley, and one of the other things that kind of goes hand in hand with that in this area is sport fishing. And on your campaign website, you do have some information up there about salmon restoration. So tell us a little bit about the salmon restoration project and your involvement with that.
Well, right now we're working with what they call a moisture incubation system, and it's used in a lot of areas. Actually, it goes all the way back to the local native populations when they used to use wicker baskets, and they would take eggs and they would take into waterfall areas and restock salmon in southeast Alaska and some areas in Yakutat to bring back fish populations that have not been there in the past. This was a design and done in Wrangell in Alaska. It's being used all over the world. And what it does is it takes the native salmon eggs, and normally you have between a 30 and 33% survivability, and it takes it to a 90%. So you're not, and it's replaced back in the gravel, and they're hatched, and they call it watermarks, so they know they come from which river, right in the river that they're taken from as native salmon. So basically what you're doing is you're increasing the survivability. So when you have the bad years and low runs, you can have more fish. If only 5% of one incubation unit survived, came back, just 5%, that'd be an extra 25,000 silvers in the Little Susitna River. And my question is what could you do if we had 25,000 more silvers in the Little Susitna River? I grew up on the Little Susitna River. I remember days when I could catch 5 and 6 silvers a day up by above the bridge by our house on out there. And today, this year there's more, but last year, the year before, I was lucky to see 1 or 2 a week go on by up through there. It was devastating. It's been bad. So it's an inexpensive system. The whole thing is in a Connex. It's portable. It goes in. It's only operating during the 180-day cycle that they're using for the fish. They're put back in. Once a river has been put back up into an area where it's sustainable that can be moved to another river, or you can continue using them. And you could put these on each of the rivers. Now, if you were just taking a portion of the salmon, putting back in to increase your numbers, everybody could be happy. Mm. You know, you wouldn't care if somebody caught some more fish someplace else as long as we had fish for our people. And I don't know, 25, you know, 5% survivability, which is less than the 10% that normally comes back.
Mm-hmm.
So you up the you catch a few more fish.
Okay.
What's wrong with that?
And so you say these are inexpensive. How much does each unit cost?
A full unit itself, all the way through, including the cost of the container and that, we're putting one fully together that can do 1 million fish a year for $75,000.
Wow.
That's it. So when you talk to, you know, we've got right now, we've got one we're working on with the Little Sustitna River. We've got the buildings, we've got the locations, we've got funding, and we've got operation cost funded for it. We went to legislature last year to get 3 incubators is what we asked for. We were turned down for 3 incubators. So now we're working with private individuals to get the funding for the incubators for Little Sustitna River. And it's interesting. You'll spend $3.4 million to study a project, but you wouldn't put $75,000 that'll actually increase the fish. And I'm really tired of seeing studies that have no action plan. You know, this $3.4 million study is going to study beaver dams again. Well, we've already got, we know what the problem with beaver dams. Fish and Game's already told the legislators what it is. We already know about the pike. We know the areas. And the Fish and Game's already told the legislators what they need to do. But nobody's willing to take the next step. So what we see is we see, especially our local representative, they throw a bunch of money at another study. But it's another. But the other study is not going to produce more fish. Someone comes along, gives them not the golden goose egg, but gives them an area that can help slow down the decline, keep the salmon coming in to the areas, and they turn their backs on it, don't even want to discuss it, work on anything else. I'm not willing to wait and see all of our fish disappear before we start producing more native salmon. I think we should be proactive from day one.
Okay. And so what's the timeline on seeing how effective this moist air incubation system ends up being for in this particular case?
It's a 2 to 3 year turnaround on silvers and longer on kings.
But right.
Our goal is to start with the silver salmon and then eventually also do king salmon along with it. And once the pilot program's finished and we show a drastic increase, we'd like to see it happen in all the rivers. And again, it's the native salmon you're taking. You're not bringing in any fish from any place else. You're just increasing the survivability of the natural the native salmon eggs from a 30 to 90%. And I can't, it surprises me sometimes when you hear some legislators scoff at such an area. But again, only 5%, 25,000 more fish, that's a lot of fish.
Hmm. So we've just got a couple of minutes left. I'd like to we've also got an unaffiliated candidate running for the state Senate seat E that covers this area and for state governor. So you've got Warren Keough running for state Senate against Mike Dunleavy, the incumbent, and you've got Bill Walker running with Byron Mallott against Governor Sean Parnell. Is there any? Have you just talked with either of those candidates? Are you in support of either of those other independent candidates?
I have not talked to Warren at all. I do see Senator Dunleavy quite regularly at different functions. I'm surprised that I go to the shooting range out here and there's Senator Dunleavy. I go to Waco, there's Senator Dunleavy, and he's always talking to folks. You know, like this year when we had the SB 77 that my opponent was pushing fastly through, didn't even show up for the town hall meeting. But you had Senator Dunleavy there to answer, at least to the public, you know, of why he was or was not supporting it. And I remember that very well. There was a large group of people that were very upset about 77. And I'd like to have heard.
I remember that meeting as well.
I'd like to have heard what he had to say, why he voted yes to fast streamline it out through here. But he wasn't there, which is not uncommon for him. He doesn't show up for very many things ever. So, Mr. Keough, I know him. Warren's a nice guy in that, but I haven't talked to him once, and nor has he come by to talk with me at all. So, I can't say because I don't know his area. Mr. Walker, I've known Walker. My dad and I've known Walker since I was real small. I've talked to him several times, but I've seen Governor Parnell several times since then too.
Okay.
So, I like both gentlemen. So coming back down to in an area, though, you know, I would like to, I see Mr. Walker as a little more aggressive than Governor Parnell.
Okay. That is just about all the time we've got for today. My guest has been Roger Purcell, candidate for State House Seat 10. If you missed any of the show or if you'd like to listen again, Sioux Valley Voice will re-air tonight at 7 o'clock, or you can listen online anytime at ktna.org. My name's Philip Manning. Thanks for listening.